Rondo Village and the real estate stunts, and you just mentioned Mission Beach. Any other?
And then I went from there to barnstorming Arizona and New Mexico, Utah, and southwestern states. Mm-hmm. One incident I will never forget, I went into Casa Grande, and to attract crowds, you always did some kind of exhibition flight over town, stunts and stuff to attract people, and then you'd find a place to land close you could to town, and usually it was in a schoolyard. I flew over Casa Grande and I did inverted flight to attract the attention of the people there, and I forgot that I had a bag of tools laying loose in the fuselage, and it fell out right in the main street, right in the middle of Main Street. So I went over and landed in a schoolyard right nearby, and the people come swarming out there, and I had my wing walker with me, and he'd sell rides, and I'd take them up for 10, 15-minute rides, $5 a ride.
Well, what was aviation like then in the 20s and 30s here in San Diego County? Was it any more involved here? Were there more aviators here, or was it the same as all over the country?
Well, there was a few aviators around. The first, when I first started, I met Ryan with a Jenny down on the Embarcadero, flying passengers, $5 a ride, 1920.
Claude Ryan?
Yes. And that's how I got acquainted with Claude Ryan in the first place. And then in those days, if I wanted spark plugs or gas, I'd sometimes fly over to North Island and land, and they'd gas me up and give me spark plugs.
Everything was much more involved.
Yeah, yes. And the one thing that really amuses me is I go to some of these here antique air shows, and they're there with 1938 and 40 airplanes, and they call them antiques.
Right.
And as far as I'm concerned, they're practically new to me.
Yeah, right.
And I went to one time, a fellow in Tucson wanted to buy an airplane from Nebraska. They called it the Lincoln Page. And he bought a Lincoln Page from the factory up there and had me go get it. And I got started back a little too late, and I got caught in the dark, and I had to land in a schoolyard in Deming. Stay all night, Deming, New Mexico, coming back.
You mentioned a lot of, course, you're standing across from Lindbergh Field, and there's quite a bit of background noise here. Yeah. It wasn't, skies weren't full of planes then, and you didn't have this noise.
How did
people look at aviators?
Dutch Flats, it was very unusual to see over five or six airplanes there on Dutch Flats. And that was when it was, they thought it was booming then.
Back in what, the 20s?
In the 22, 23, 24.
How did the people react to you as a flyer? I mean, were they friendly and stuff when you landed, you know, when you had to land? Or?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they were very friendly. You never had any trouble. The farmers were very so glad to see your airplane and see you come in. They didn't care if you landed in their wheat fields. Because they're so glad to see you that they forget about the damage you were doing.
Right.
Take them up for a ride. And
it was a novelty then for them.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was a novelty. And sometimes we had to sleep under the wings at night, just get under the wing. And
so you didn't make a lot of money with your plane, and just you and
No, I didn't make any. I didn't make any money. I just made, didn't even make expenses. I had to sleep on the ground some nights under the plane.
But you enjoyed every minute of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did it for the fun. And the money I took in just helped pay the expenses.
Was it expensive to keep up an old plane like that in those days?
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't expensive. part of the time when I was here, I went to work in the garage as troubleshooter and foreman in that garage, and I'd fly out of Orlando on weekends. And the airplane got to where it needed some work done on it, so I tore it down and took it and put it in the backyard of this garage and recovered it, and they overhauled the engine right there in the garage.
Wow.
And it really helped our business there, too. People saw you working on an airplane, they felt you knew your business.
How did you get, like, the job at Orlando and Mission Beach? Did they just call you, or did you try to get this kind of work, or what?
Well,
want to walk a bit?
I was working in the garage at that time when I went to Orlando, and my brother-in-law wanted to get me out of that garage and get me going on aviation. So he went out there to Orlando and arranged for me to meet those people and had me make a deal with them. Come out there and fly and put on exhibition flights to attract customers, potential customers, to buy lots in the subdivision. The bulldozers were working all around us there. And I'd put on a parachute jump about on Saturdays and Sundays. My parachute jumper's still here, and one of them was from North Island, did some of the jumping.
And he's still alive here?
No, I don't know whether he's still alive or not. He was the chief in charge of the parachute division at North Island Naval Air Station. I sold my old Jenny when I was in Tucson. We put on shows there for a fellow that married a cousin of mine, had an airport, what they call South Airport in Tucson, and we would attract crowds every weekend by putting on stunts, and one of the stunts was my wing walker made a wire ladder and he put it on the landing gear, and he'd hang on that wire ladder upside down, and somebody'd throw a hat out on the ground, and I'd fly him down, and he'd scoop it up with his hands hanging upside down. And we'd pass the hat then to the crowd to get a little money.
You mentioned you bought your plane. These are World War I surplus planes, were they?
Yes.
That's how everybody got their planes in those days? You didn't have to pay anywhere near what the Army or...
Well, I didn't get mine from the military service. I got it from a fellow who had bought it. Martin Jensen, he's one of the Dole Flyers. He'd come in second place in the Dole Flight. And he had it sitting there on Dutch Flats for sale, $300.
That's not anywhere near what the government paid for it.
No, no.
But Jenny, a brand new Jenny, well, how much about those?
I don't know what they paid for them in the crates. But after flying a thing for 9 years, I sold it for $900.
Wow. Why did they sell all the Jennies? Someone said that they weren't going to have any Air Force after World War I. Was that it? Or?
Well, they just didn't need all of them. They needed some of them, but they didn't need as many as they had for peacetime operations. They're just laying out in the crates, and they felt they might as well get something out of them, because as time went on, they were improving airplanes and getting different models, and these planes are becoming more or less obsolete because of the age of the outmoded part.
Now tell us something about the plane itself, the Jenny.
Well, Jenny had the OX-5, Curtiss OX-5 engine, which is a 90 horsepower engine, and it burned 9 gallons an hour of gas. It had open rocker arms, and you had to go about every 2 hours of flying, you'd get up there with a can, a squirt can, and oil the rocker arms and the valve system. And one of the troubles we had was right after you'd oil them, if you happened to fly too soon, you'd have that oil coming back in your face. I'd build I'd box those in then and put a lid on, so I'd just raise the lid up and oil them and close it up so that oil wouldn't come back in my face. And then the fuselage part was, and the wings were birch and wire and metal. The only upkeep you had on, as far as the airplane's concerned, is primarily a fabric. And maybe a tire if you happen to get in a bad, land in a bad spot. Maybe spoil a tire or two, which happened quite often.
They didn't have these paved runways and all that.
Oh, no, paved runways. You couldn't, they had tail skids built to drag in it, and they acted as a brake. Tail skid acted as a brake when it was dragging through the ground. And you couldn't use those at all on the pavement like they have now.
But there weren't many paved fields then anyway.
Well, there wasn't any.
Any.
No, paved runways, I don't recall, but I don't think they came in until sometime in the 30s.
So it was a dirt runway or a field?
Yeah, they're all dirt runways until sometime in the 30s.
And even the streets you landed in, they were kind of dirt streets. They weren't paved either.
Oh, yeah, dirt streets.
Yeah.
And I recall one time I was going to Los Angeles from here, and I got up around Oceanside and I decided I need gas, and there's a service station just the other side of Oceanside, and I landed and gassed up there at that service station.
It's regular gas.
Yeah. I remember one time we were trying to go into Nevada do some barnstorming. I got San Bernardino in a real heavy windstorm, north windstorm, and I kept climbing, thought I could get above the wind, and I finally got up around, and I had a swing walker in front of me in the front cockpit. I got up around 22,000 feet, and I noticed his head had flopped over, and he had run out of oxygen. So I dove it right down right quick, and I was getting kind of weak myself trying to get over this windstorm, and decided that I would land under a ridge on a plateau that came down from the ridge, and wait until the wind died down. I landed, and he jumped out and grabbed the tail, and we turned it around, tail into the wind, and the rocks were stinging our ankles, it was blowing so hard. And so we decided to, finally the wind wasn't going to die down, so we finally took off and come back from San Bernardino in 20 minutes to San Diego in that tailwind. That's how hard it was blowing.
They didn't have pressurized cabins, of course. What kind of an oxygen system did you have?
Didn't have any.
I mean, did you have to put a mask over your face, or how did it work?
No, all we had was goggles and a helmet.
Oh, no
other
oxygen.
Helmet. No
you
oxygen.
Didn't carry any at all.
No oxygen. Wasn't heard of then.
So how did you? How did when you got too high? You got a little lightheaded. Is that?
Yeah, you're dizzy.
And then you knew you were.
Yeah. I've been up. I was up. That's the highest I ever went in an airplane without oxygen. 22,000.
What about the performance of the Jenny?
Well, the Jenny. The primary stunt of the Jenny. The most feasible stunt to pull with the Jenny is a tailspin. And a tailspin, what causes a tailspin is stalling the airplane, slowing it down lower than flying speed. And then it just falls off on one wing, and you kick a rudder, and it just goes around and around and around.
But you have to know how to get back out of it, don't you?
And then when you want to get out of it, you just straighten up the rudder and push the stick forward and dive it and get up speed and pull it out. And I got to where I would spin right down and pull it out and land right out of a tailspin. Dive looked like you're going to spin right into the ground.
People like that down the
road. Oh, yes, yeah. But I did it so much, a tailspin is my favorite with Jenny.
Well, how did you said you'd learned it at in the Army or Navy?
Navy at North Island, 1918.
So that's where you really learned how to fly.
I volunteered in the Naval Reserve in 1918 in Arizona, and I was working in a mine. They shipped me out here and to North Island, and put me through school at North Island. Okay. We put in 10 hours a day in school.
But your barnstorming and that, you learned all that. They didn't teach you how to stunt fly, did they?
Oh, no. No.
How did you learn all that? Just by...
After we started barnstorming, we didn't do any stunting to mount anything in the service. Just learned to take off and land. That was about all we did.
So you learned it kind of on your own, then?
Yes. We had to do these idiotic things in order to attract crowds.
But sometimes you were doing them for the first time?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, finally, you just worked into it.
There were a lot of barnstormers in those days, in the 20s?
Yes. Some of the barnstormers would gang up and travel together, as in a group, three or four of them ranged together. But I didn't do that at all. I was a loner all the time.
Did you know many of the other ones? Get together occasionally?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I met several of them. One of them I met, I introduced him to my cousin, and they got married. He's an old-timer from Oklahoma. He's part Indian. Charlie Mays.
So the barnstormers, they find it a little difficult flying nowadays, the differences.
Well, yeah, you can't go in and land and haul passengers. Like, you got to get on an airport to do it.
So flying today is pretty tame.
Yeah, there's no barnstorming today. Unless it's in where they're having an antique air show or something like that, you might... be on the edge of barnstorming, taking people up for a ride and at an air show. But that's about all I'm out to now.
Well, I know you had a Curtis Jenny. Any other planes that you had or that you flew?
Yes, I had what they called a Waco 10 with a 150 hissel in it, 150 horsepower hissel. I bought it from one of the Spreckles boys here in San Diego. And I crashed that up the Colorado River jungle.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that on the videotape, that crash. Any other crashes you had or close calls?
Well, I was with this Charlie Mays that married my cousin. He was, when they met, we went into my uncle's farm and landed. And that's where he met my cousin, and he wanted to take her for a ride. And, of course, I went along, and we started take off. And we hit some mud in the field that we didn't know was there, and slowed him down so slow that he couldn't clear the fence. And we hit the fence and landed in a wood pile in the neighbor's yard, wood pile. When no one was hurt, it wrecked the plane, but didn't hurt anybody.
When you wrecked a plane, a Jenny or a plane like that, how much did it take to get it back together again?
Well, we worked on that plane about 2 months. We had to get another propeller from back east someplace. It took us about 2 months, and after we got it fixed, he took it and tested it. When he come back, he told my cousin to get in, and they had it arranged between themselves that they were going to elope. And when they took off, they went to El Paso and were married. Arizona.
Well, when you repaired your own, you had to learn how to repair your own planes. You had to learn tune your own engine, everything.
Yes, yes.
The pilot wasn't just a pilot. He was a mechanic.
He was a mechanic, yes. He had to do all his own repair work. There was no mechanics around to do it.
So you trusted yourself as far as...
Oh, yes. Well, I'm a natural born mechanic. I can go clear back to my great-grandfather and great-great-grandfathers. They're all mechanics. And I started working in my granddad's blacksmith shop when I was 6 years old, 1902. And I had my fingers in mechanics every chance I got since then.
You mentioned briefly when we were doing the videotape that you've been doing a lot of jobs. Besides, I mean, you work with a job for a while and then you learn it and then you want to get on to something
else. Yeah,
talk about that a bit.
I'm a type of a guy that I just retiring is my least of my concern. My concern is happiness. And if I am on a job and becomes too routine, whereas there's no reason for trying to figure something out, or nothing involved, or it gets too easy, I don't like it. Unless it's something that's challenging, I don't want it. I don't want anything to do with it. I like to look at new country and new faces and do new things, different things all the time.
It's always been that way for you?
Yes. I'm a carpenter, a welder, a metalsmith, a blacksmith. I built houses, and I've done a little of everything. And my granddad, when I helped him in the blacksmith shop, he was building wagons and buggies. He had an iron with his name on it, and he'd put his brand on the buggies and wagons he built. I still have that brand. His name was W. Ballard, William, and of course mine's Walter, and I use it occasionally.
What about, when did the airport first come to San Diego?
Lindbergh?
Yeah. Was that the first airport here?
Yes, Lindbergh was the first airport for commercial use.
Right.
And it opened up right around 1930, I believe. I was 32 when I flew the first transcontinental airmail off Lindbergh Field.
And it was in a different location then?
Oh, yeah. The depot was over on Pacific where the restaurant is now. And there wasn't anything west of that, west Pacific at all. It just opened, and it was all, they're still filling it in, the dredges.
So what kind of progress, if you want to call it that, have you seen, like in planes and commercial airliners and that? When they first started, they were small and...
Yeah, when they first started, that's fantastic. I can't believe that, that airplanes do the things that they do. It bore me to death to fly on an airline now because it's more or less a push-button deal.
Right.
It's got to have a sticker, a wheel, and rudders and stuff for me.
But the airliners, the commercial airliners that flew people, you mentioned that you in the Grand Canyon and other places you've worked, they were relatively small planes compared to the ones.
Well, they were 12, 14 passenger.
Then they just grew larger and larger?
Yes.
How long did that take about?
Well, they just gradually grew to where they are now. Just kept improving and improving. And I quit flying at the end of World War II, and that's when the jets came in. I never did get into the jets. Mm-hmm. All propeller stuff. And I started in 18 and quit in 45. Started in World War I, quit at the end of World War II.
That was a big change, the propeller plane to the jet then.
Yeah, and when the war ended, I was superintendent of airplane engine repair at Naval Air Station Corpus Christi. And they released me to inactive duty then, like they did in the First War. I stayed in reserve in the First War, and they called me back in World War II.
When you first started flying, people were a little afraid of flying. I mean, the passengers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of them afraid to fly. A lot of them afraid to fly, but there was enough of them that wanted to that we didn't have a problem under barnstorming getting enough passengers to fly.
How about, like, when you were with the Grand Canyon Airlines and other, say, at 12 passengers? What kind of people flew then? That would be in the 30s or what?
Well, I started with them in 36.
Okay.
And there was people from all over the United States and other countries on vacations. We'd come up there and we'd fly them down the canyon. Actually, go down in it. And sometimes the canyon would be overcast. And we'd go down in the canyon like flying through a tunnel.
I guess I was trying to figure out, were the first passengers as much of an adventurer as the pilots were? Oh, yeah.
In the early days?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, there were a lot of people that were, that you couldn't get in a plane. They were still taking trains and...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the people that flew as passengers, they were kind of excited about aviation, too, probably.
Yeah, a lot of our people at the Grand Canyon were celebrities like movie stars. Katharine Hepburn, one time she took my picture in a movie.
Now, the transcontinental mail flight, you said was what year that you flew out of San Diego?
June the 15th, 1932.
Okay, what other flights did you have out of San Diego or on San Diego?
At that time, well, they had, just before that happened, before we made that flight, 1930, Western Air Express had a run that I was on, and we flew from Los Angeles to San Diego, flying on Lindbergh Field, 1930, and El Centro, Phoenix, Tucson, Douglas, and El Paso. One day, and then come back the next, and we called it the milk route because we stopped so many times on the route.
Is that freight and passengers?
Passengers, and mail. We had a little mail then. And we called it the milk route because we...
Thank you, Walter, very much.